Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy beautiful sunny Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Well, that was a mouthful, Hank.
Yeah.
Happy Tuesday to you. Happy birthday to my son-in-law also. He's 33 years old today. I don't ever do birthday shout-outs.
You don't. Even on my birthday, you never say a word.
I know. I'm so sorry, but I just was feeling it because I'm feeling love for my son-in-law today. And there we go. And it is a beautiful day to celebrate. And it's a big day here for the show because we're kind of joining in this national effort or this national conversation that NPR has been promoting this week about voter anxiety or the anxious voter. And I don't know if you've been tuning in or listening to some of the different shows or conversations or stories that have geared around, you know, how do American voters feel about this election cycle? What are the issues that matter most to them, and how can we make the most of our voting rights, exercising our rights to vote this year? So we are going to take that topic of the anxious voter or the election year opportunities and kind of morph them a bit into how our mental health plays into the whole election process, how anxiety that we feel plays into the election process, and how we can hopefully make changes or take opportunities or relate to each other in such a way that we can actually make our individual votes make a difference on a grander scale. Because I think in some ways, a lot of this conversation is singing to the choir, that a lot of people listening tend to share similar values or feelings or concerns about the direction of the country or the state of the environment or the state of the universe, for that matter. But one of the things that we rarely talk about is what drives the way we feel. And why is it that we become passionate or engaged or activated around certain issues or topics? And so I want to talk about the role that anxiety plays in our decision making to see if that strikes a chord with you. And I also want to open up the phone line today to ask you, what are the issues that are most important to you this election year or this election cycle or in the world in general? And do you believe that we can actually elect politicians that will be able to address those issues that you care the most about? Because just to put my hand out there right at the beginning, I often wonder if we can elect politicians that are going to bring about the change that we so desire. Because I think a lot of the things that, and if I'm speaking for all of us, but some of the things that we care the most about, I don't know if they can be legislated, you know, fairness and equality. Yes, we can pass laws that will promote fairness and equality, but we've had laws on the books for years that weren't enforced, that didn't bring us any further along in the conversation of fairness and equality. So I don't know if it can be legislated. It feels like it has to be something that happens from the ground up, from the people coming together and deciding, hey, this no longer works for us, and changing the way we behave. And I think that has a lot to do with other conversations about the shrinking middle class. Yes, it has a lot to do with policies and laws and ways that things are unequal for different people in the country. But we also need to have a conversation about what it is we value. You know, are we really about attaining great material wealth? Or are there other ways that we should be approaching the American dream? And when we change that conversation, do we change the way legislation happens? I guess my point is that a lot of our behavior when it comes to electing officials doesn't get us the results we want, because politicians are very well-versed, they're trained. The political machine, whatever that is, whether it's a Democratic machine or a Republican machine, there is a big business behind both of the parties that kind of drive our political system. They are very wise. They're savvy. They know how to work social media, and they totally understand how marketing works. And so that's where I see a lack of connection between, you know, trying to make rational voting decisions to select an elected official, and realizing that it doesn't matter which elected official we put our stamp of approval on, unless we as people forcibly change our conversations amongst ourselves, we're never going to get things done. So let me see if I can make sense of this for you. Some of my closest friends and I have very different political belief systems, very different belief systems about what is important in life, very different belief systems about climate change or the environment or terrorism. We have very polar views, and we don't have conversations about them because that would probably be the end of our friendships. And so we end up being, to use a common term that's very popular today, we live in our own silos of our belief systems, you know, that we just kind of live in our silos. But when we're together socially, we step out of those silos and we find safe conversations to have. And so my feeling is, when the election cycle rolls along, when it's time to cast my ballot for a politician, that in many ways, no matter how educated I am about my options, my vote generally is canceled out by my best friends, because they're so rooted in their silos of belief system that they're going to vote in with the politician that supports and makes them feel better about their belief system. And I support the politicians that make me feel better about my belief system. And then we just cancel each other out. And so this nagging feeling that I have that it's all for naught needs to be changed makes me think that the conversation we should be having today in ongoing is trying to find commonality between our two silos, right? Trying to find issues that we can talk about and agree on, or find some middle ground, you know, that we need to, as friends and neighbors in a community, have conversations and say, okay, maybe, you know, I don't fully buy into the idea of climate change, or maybe I don't fully buy into this idea of the shrinking middle class and needing to, you know, make more opportunities. Whatever it is that you differ on with your closest friends, but to find some middle piece that you can say, you know what, I am on board with this. Maybe we need to come together and talk about how to have better educational opportunities for our children. We can all get behind that, that if we can help educate our children and give them more opportunities, that they will have the capacity to address some of these greater issues. And so my thought is that if we as voters can find common ground and then come together on whatever those issues are we care most about, we can drive the policies of the politicians. Because what happens now is that the politicians come out and they tell their story about what they think the public wants to hear. They say the inflammatory, fear-mongering things that get us all activated and riled up and emotional. And we vote based on who, you know, offers the greatest solution to our emotional discomfort. But then nothing changes, because the politicians don't need to change how they do business, because we as voters can't come together and demand that they make change, right? So if we have Democrats in power, all the Democrats say, yay, this is great, but our Republican friends block any opportunity to change what's happening. And so the politicians never really need to back up any of their promises, because the voters can't come together in enough force to force change. Right? We hold on to the fact that, well, my man's in power, so we're going to now follow all of my beliefs. That's not going to get us there. So that's just my feeling, is that if we could somehow diminish our own anxiety about those things that we view as threats, to take a few breaths, to try to find some common ground with the people that tend to have opposite or polar feelings, then we can come together as a human block, instead of a political voting block, but come together as a human block and force politics to be different. So that's kind of where I'm at today. And if you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're always invited to be part of this conversation, either through our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can like us and get updates on what we're going to be talking about. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. We have a website, The Reluctant Therapist. I've been tweeting a little more than usual, hashtag EBTRT, Elizabeth Barrett, The Reluctant Therapist. And you can listen to previous shows by podcasting through iTunes. You can subscribe to The Reluctant Therapist and they will download shows to your devices. Or you can stream our shows by visiting kcbx.org under the News and Talk tab. We're right at the top there. And all of our shows are available from the last few years, actually, if you want to catch up. So we'd love you to be a part of it. And we also invite you to be a part of the conversation today. 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of the conversation. And I'm not alone here in the studio today. I actually invited a co-pilot in, someone who has some expertise in the world of political commentary or political writing. My guest, Jackie Marcus.
Yes.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Elizabeth.
She's a poet. She was a philosophy professor for 20 years. And when she retired, she became a contributing political writer for truthout.org, sharing her wisdom, feeling like she's still teaching in some way by sharing your knowledge about political issues.
Yes.
And so I invited Jackie in to kind of talk a bit about her experience with hot button issues and how policies are made, and also to kind of back me up with callers who might ask questions that I have no idea how to respond to. So thanks for coming in, Jackie.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And I love your show. Listen to it every Tuesday.
You. I'm glad you do.
Yeah, it's just kind of weird to be on the other side of the radio today.
You mean to be sitting so close to me?
Well, you know, usually I got my radio on in my kitchen listening to you, and all of a sudden here I am inside the radio on your But I think this is you're going in an interesting place on this question, because I often find having conversations with Republicans that there is common ground. I happen to be a Democrat and a liberal, but Truthout, we are a nonprofit organization, and so we discuss the issues anywhere from humanitarian issues and social injustice issues, poverty, climate change, and so forth. But we are not allowed to advocate for any one candidate. But I thought about this question that you have raised. You know, what is it that we do have in common with each other? Because if Republicans and Democrats could get together, my gosh, can you imagine what could happen? You know, and what happens in the political field is it's all about division. It's all about dividing us up. And I think that's deliberate, because we got to start thinking, in my opinion, as all Americans. First of all, we are. We're all Americans. And if we were to travel outside of our country, and if we were, you know, in desperate straits somewhere in some other country, and we ran into some other American, I don't care whether that person is, you know, Republican, independent, or anything. I'd just be happy to say, "Oh, you're from the United States. Great." And you know,
there's some comfort in that commonality.
Yes, and I think we should take pride in that. That let's begin with the premise first that, hold on, folks, we're all Americans. We're all in this together.
So the challenge, though, again, is finding that common ground.
Right.
And I think, you know, from a therapist point of view, if I were having warring couple in my office,
right?
Marital therapy quite often is like a political war, because you have two people with very opposing feelings about what's happening. You know, you can be in the same marriage, in the same situation, have very different views about what needs to happen here. So I think about the political unrest is how I would handle a couple that comes in for help. And one of the things that we work on most is, yes, you are rooted in the ways that you're angry and disappointed in how the other person is behaving.
Right.
You know, so we can get so caught up in the ways that we dislike the way the other person's behaving. We get so rooted in the ways that we don't feel heard, or we feel dismissed, or we feel disrespected because our opinions aren't being heard, that both parties just shut down, right? We stop listening to our spouse. We don't want to hear them because we feel like, I've listened to you enough. Now it's all, I just want to think about me.
This is so funny because I had this argument with my husband today. Were you listening in?
Usually. You know, I'm somewhere. And so what
happens? Because, we, you know, once in a while we have these clashes that you're speaking about. Not, I mean, we usually have a lot in common, but today, you know, there are times where he just tells me to shut up. And then that's the end of the conversation.
And the clashes are common in marriages. Yeah. And that's why I make the connection to our political fights. Because in order for couples to heal that divide, both have to be willing to put down their swords, right? Put down their defenses, to put down their anger and say, okay, I'm not going to be so tied to the things that I believe, ways I've been wronged. I'm actually going to try to put myself in your shoes and hear from your perspective why it is you feel so strongly about this issue.
Right.
And so once the other partner can say, I may not agree with, and let's say it's talked about child rearing for one example. You know, I may not agree that you want to be more open to letting the kids do more things, but I can understand from the way you were raised and your parents were very strict with you that this would feel oppressive and that you want our children to have more freedom.
Right.
And just by acknowledging that you can understand why your partner has come up with a different perspective and why they're choosing the direction they are based on how they were raised or based on the experiences they had, then you start to soften your defenses.
Right.
And then your partner might be able to say, well, then I guess I do understand why you want to crack down a bit on the kids, because I have noticed that they've been running a little wild, and because you had way too, you know, a lot of freedom growing up, that it was important for you that there had be more boundaries. And that's where we start to see healing with couples. So I think it's the same with our political divides with our friends. And I talk about our friends because we have to start with our friendships
somewhere.
Somewhere, because we're not going to get strangers on board if we can't get our friends on board. And so to start having polite discourse with our friends over our political differences, and instead of fighting about how we disagree, to find out why is it you feel the way you do about climate change? Is there a fear that if we do acknowledge climate change, that you will feel so overcome with anxiety that you'll feel frozen?
Right.
And so I can understand that overwhelm, that sense that the world's coming to an end, would cause you to want to find evidence to the contrary.
Right.
Right?
Right. On this idea of how do you phrase the language in such a way that you don't alienate your friends? So I think this is where you're going. Mm-hmm. And I have had this conversation with climate change deniers, and they're wherever they're getting their information, and they've been strongly influenced by that. So I think to be a good place to start, if you're clashing on climate change, is you could go on and talk about the science and the community of scientists, and they know all that. They've already heard it, and yet still they say, I would just ask a simple question, begin at a very basic understanding that we all can relate to, and that is the question of, well, do you like pollution? Period. You know, do you like pollution? Does anybody like pollution? Let's start there before we even get into the climate change. Let's start with that question. How many people like smelling smog? How many people like to see, you know, their air polluted or their water polluted? You know, Republicans care just as much about those questions, I would assume, for their children, making sure that they have clean water, clean air to breathe. We've got this problem going on right now in Los Angeles with this methane leak that drove everybody out of that neighborhood, and it's kind of a ghost town. Now, that's something I would think we would all be able to agree with, whether you're Republican or a Democrat. That's a nasty thing nobody wants to be exposed to.
The problem, is if we start with that question, we're already putting people on the defensive. And I think where I'm coming to it is from a different angle. It's not asking someone, do you like pollution? Because if you were my spouse and you said that, I would already be angry at you. you for treating me so disrespectfully acting like, no, do you think I would like pollution? So just to, for argument's sake, what I'm really talking about is instead of trying to question someone to get them to change their mind, to really drop your need to make other people agree with you. To drop that need to get them to change their mind and be on your team, and to really try to understand from their perspective why they feel as strongly as they do, because that's how we then drop our defensive and find things that we can agree on. Because my guess is, and again, I hope that a Republican caller or someone with very conservative values will call in and talk about why they believe so strongly about, climate change not being what it is. I mean, those conversations are important to have, because my guess is that underneath it all is one, there is a sense of overwhelm that if we were to say climate change is real and there's nothing we can do about it, that fear would drive people to be frozen. But also there's the economic fear that if we are to allow climate change policies to be enacted, if we elect a socialist president, which people, conservatives fear with Bernie Sanders, that they will lose their jobs or their livelihood or their ability to take care of their family. And so we can't talk about climate change action until we help people who are afraid of losing their livelihood or their homes or, their sense of well-being, that's not going to happen.
Right.
So we open this up to you. Where are you on this conversation? Are you able to talk with your best friends or your closest friends or colleagues about political issues or sensitive issues or the election year or candidates? Do you even bother, or do you live in your silo? And do you think there is an ability, is there any chance that we could start with the polite discourse amongst our social groups to start finding common ground? I really feel that in some ways it doesn't matter who we elect. If we as a populace can't come together and demand of our elected officials the change that we see important. Because I think where we are now is with two parties that are saying whatever they feel like they need to say to keep the populace anxious so that they'll stay elected. But they have no intention of really following through and making any change, because they know in their hearts they don't have the political will or the votes to make any great change, because we as voters don't force them or demand them to make the changes we want. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm joined in the studio by my guest, Jackie Marcus. We're kind of touch and go going through this conversation about the anxious voter. Do you feel anxious about this election year? Do you feel like that this is the election that's going to make or break the direction of our nation for eternity? 805-781-3875. And just to give you all a little background, NPR sent out this information about what people are feeling nationally are the three biggest issues facing us in this election year. The first one is economic uncertainty, the idea of the shrinking middle class, and this idea that since 1971, the middle class has shrunk from being approximately 62% of Americans, and now only 43% of Americans could be considered living in the middle class. Does that concern you? That our wages have been stagnant, that our quality of life has not improved since the 70s, and without some sort of changes, that's going to continue to be an issue. Number two is the idea of terrorism and the question about whether or not you feel secure. Key findings were that many Americans are fearful of a terrorist attack. Right now, 79% of Americans feel that we are more likely to have a terrorist attack now than at any time since 9/11. 44% of you believe an attack is very likely in the next few months. And 7 out of 10 of you say that the fight against ISIS is going badly. And yet, on the other hand, people don't like the approach of banning Muslim immigration or tightening up our security laws or taking away rights. So where are you in the world of the terrorism conversation? And then the third big issue that seems to come up a lot for voters is the idea of the changing national identity and how we're going to see changes in our communities and in our workplace and our identity as a nation. So that's what the NPR studies came up with, is the three big issues making voters anxious. And I'm curious to know if there are other issues for you. Jackie, for you, climate change is missing from that list.
Yeah, that's interesting. And we did already have touched on that a tad. And I just wanted to pick up on a really important point that you mentioned at the beginning of your introduction on having a groundswell movement and being unified, because this is what really gets the change going, not from our necessarily from our politicians, but putting that pressure onto our politicians. And, you know, I would like to remind the listeners out there of what it took for women, for an example, to get the vote, and what it took for blacks to get that vote, and, you know, the women's suffrage movement, for an example. It started at the end of the 1790, there you go. And you know, all the women that had to demonstrate over decades and decades and risked their lives and were arrested and thrown in prison and tortured, all for this precious thing called the right to vote. So no matter how disenfranchised you feel, or no matter how apathetic you may feel like, oh, what the heck, my vote's not going to count, it's all, the system's rigged. I would urge those of you who are falling into that perception to remember what people have given. They have given their lives. They have sacrificed their lives for this precious thing called the right, and it is a fundamental foundation of our democracy.
It is. And it's interesting about, it's funny because at yesterday's lecture in class to my students was about the women's movement and the three waves of it, and starting with the suffragist movement that started in 1790 and ended with the vote in 1920. Right. But the thing that I find interesting about the women's movement is that it's one of the only revolutions we've had in history that was done without a drop of blood being shed. Right. That it was all about consistent, you know, walking
persistence,
the talk and persistence, and, yes, and years and years and years of dedication. So when it comes to issues like climate change or the shrinking middle class, that we can't expect that in 4 years we're going to see a complete resolution, that we as a populace have to come together and know what our resolve is, because the politicians are going to change over many, many times before we get to where we need to be as a country when it comes to these issues. So that's even more of a reason why we need to understand our goals as voters, even more so than caring about who our politicians are. But maybe I'm off base. We'd love to hear from you. 805-781-3875. What matters to you this election year? Are you feeling the anxiety? Steve, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hello. I've been following the issue, and I'm a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. If you go to citizensclimatelobby.org, all the economic models are there, a study by REMI, a regional economic forecaster, shows clearly that if you change to a green economy, we're all be better off in that regard. Christine Lagarde of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, said nothing threatens, man's emergence from poverty in most of the terrible places in the world as much as climate change, and indeed threatens us all. We don't have time. We don't have time for that nice reasoned approach that went along with so many other issues of change that we've had in the past. The CO2 is accumulating so fast, and the heating is exceeding all the computer projections, actually. So we need to put a price on carbon. We need to make sure that unfettered pollution from burning fossil fuels, which goes on now, burn as much as you want without any problems, except for in a few places where they have instituted a carbon tax, and that's working out well in places like British Columbia and so forth. So it has to happen now. It has to be related to carbon release. If that place that's emitting methane right now would have had to pay a tax on the carbon that they deposited in the ground, you bet they would have should have put a valve on that place that's now spewing methane into the air.
But Steve, I hear your concerns, but yeah, in a way, aren't we just singing to the choir having this conversation here on a public radio station? I mean, because I don't think we'd have a lot of listeners that would be deniers. So my question today really is, how do you get this story, this concern, this anxiety that I hear in your voice, how do we take this message to the people who are uncomfortable with that reality and help them to find comfort in accepting the need for change? Because to me, that's the big question.
I just told you how to do that. Please, it's all on the website, and I don't have time to explain all that.
All right, but then I appreciate you taking the time to call.
I was just going to add to that that this goes to your idea of how politicians are maybe sold as products. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people have been unified, and I agree with Steve. That this is a serious problem.
Absolutely.
That we need to address very quickly.
Absolutely.
I'm thinking that when we get together and we put initiatives, that's another reason why you want to go out and vote too, not just for the candidates, but there's some very important propositions and initiatives that are on the ballot that apply to our local community and the mm-hmm. state. And it wasn't all that long ago that it was put on the ballot whether we wanted to expand on fracking. Well, unfortunately, a lot of the people, organizations, environmental groups, just didn't have the money to match against fossil fuels. And so that is why before the election, every time you turned on the television, there were ads, you know, over and over again on, you know, going against this idea of expanding fracking.
Exactly. So this ability to market issues to enough people that they'll come out and vote against their own well-being is precisely the conversation I want to have today, is that
yes.
It does us no good to have all of us in our own silo saying, yes, this is horrible. We don't have time. We have to change. We have to get out of our silo and get to the people who are influenced by these fear ads and help them find comfort with voting another way in the face of the fear ads making them believe that if they don't vote in this way, they're going to lose their rights or their guns or their livelihood. And I guess that is where I continue going, is that we can sing all day long on this right. station about this and all agree, and I'm sorry I cut Steve short, but I think that the yeah. conversation has to be, how do we get outside of where we all agree and help one, understand why people would feel the way they do on the other side, and two, to come together to make a difference. Because yes, we can have the best propositions ever, but if we don't help educate people about the effect of marketing right to their right. fears, then we're stuck with the same issue.
Right.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Jackie Marcus. She's a poet. She's a philosophy professor. She is a political contributor to truthout.org. And we're talking about anxious voting and the anxious voter today, and keeping in line with NPR's conversation, national conversation, about how do we address those issues that concern us the most. We look forward to having you join this conversation, 805-781-3875. You're listening to Public Radio, KCBX. Amy, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, it's really overwhelming. There's so many issues that can touch your topic. I don't even know where to start, just waiting to talk to you. I thought of five more things. But but really, I would define myself politically as a Republican, but ideologically more as a Democrat, I guess, where my values are maybe more in line with the Democratic Party, but I like the Republican idea of more local-based, smaller government. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So, anyways, I just was thinking about so many times I agree with both sides on so many things and disagree with both sides on so many things. I feel more and more alienated from the whole political arena and completely. And I think I'm 30, and I think a lot of people in my age group, young families, young parents, feel the same way as I do about politics, where we, you know, think that climate change is a given, like it's happening, it's real, we need to deal with it. But we also, you know, care about our jobs and developing the economy, and we have all of these interests that maybe don't line up with any particular party. And instead of getting louder and sort of voicing our opinions, we tend to just withdraw from politics altogether. Mm-hmm. And so I have recently come to the conclusion that it's really important to start staying involved and talking about these things in a non-aggressive way. And I think that there maybe are more people that feel the same way as I do than I think, but when none of us talk about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyways, all that to say, another thing that alienates me from politics in general or makes me shy away from discussing it is so many people have opinions on things they don't know anything about, and or they'll ask me to have an opinion on something I don't know anything about, and I feel obligated to come up with one. A few years ago, there was a measure on California ballot about chicken eggs, about expanding the size of chicken cages. And, you know, most people would read it, and it was worded, do you think that we should expand the size of chicken cages to be large enough for chickens to stretch their wings? And I think most people read that and are like, well, of course chickens should be able to stretch their wings. And yes, let's by all means do that. And you'd be a horrible person if you didn't vote yes on that. But then when it came down to it, all my friends that were veterinarians were saying this is actually really bad for the health of chickens because now they're putting them in these large cages where they're killing each other and they're eating each other, and it's really bad for the birds in general and spreading disease. So maybe chickens should have more room, but this isn't the best way to go about it. So there are things like that where I feel like people are voicing their opinions off of these emotional, you know, emotionally driven decisions on things they don't know enough about that should be handed over to specialists, maybe.
Well, and Amy, because one of the things you're bringing up is, again, the power of advertising and marketing in being able to sway the electorate. And as Jackie mentioned, those who have enough money to put these ads up tend to do well in elections. So then it goes back to my original argument, which is then how do we have these polite conversations with those people we care about? As you mentioned, you and your friends don't even have these conversations because of the concern of it not going anywhere or alienating each other or feeling you're disempowered. And I just want to side note to you, at 30 years old, you're part of the millennial generation, and there are more millennials than any other population out there at this moment. And you can come together as a voting block and change the course of the world. If climate change was your issue as a millennial voting block, you could pass through any law. The downside is that so many millennials feel disenfranchised, and I don't know if you realize that you have the numbers. You have the numbers to elect whoever you want and to change the course of the future. But as a generation, you've been so sold this idea that you can't make a difference, and you spend so much time on social media, you know, looking at things that don't matter, that you've wasted your technological power to take this device that most old people don't know how it works and could change it. So I just want to encourage you to take this frustration you feel, or this disenfranchisement, or this kind of sense of not belonging to either party, and have a party at your house, a dinner party with 15 of your friends, and throw these conversations on the table. And that's how political will changes. That's how revolution begins on small and larger scales, because you do have the power. I think we've been sucked up into the circus of debates and Trump and Sanders into thinking it's all out of our hands and out of our reach, but it's not. So, Amy, thanks for taking the time to call and representing your generation a little bit.
Of course. Yeah, and one last thought is, I think because we're so saturated with information and social media, it is very disillusioning to every single candidate. You hear so much gossip and so much dirt about everybody that by the time it comes to election, I feel like we're just so disillusioned that we just don't have any faith in politics to accomplish anything of purpose or value. Mm-hmm. We're much more likely to go out and, you know, hang out at our local coffee shop and have some meaningful conversation with people, but not to go out and vote. Does that make sense?
No, I hear you.
It's hard for us to see politics as meaningful in any way as it affects our day-to-day lives.
So I'll just remind...
That's the struggle.
And I hear you, but I want to remind you, as Jackie mentioned, look at the suffragist movement. Look at the civil rights movement. They were common people who came together and had enough dinner time conversations that they all said that we've had enough. We can't wait for the politicians to make the change. We need to walk on this issue until we make a difference. So, Amy, That's where we are. And thanks for calling in. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, 805-781-3875. Tom, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. I'm a millennial conservative, so I thought I might throw in my ideas in talking about how do we relate, you know, to each other, find that common ground.
Yes.
I really, really liked what you said about, you know, even having a dinner party with 10, 15 people, because from what I've found, you know, I have, obviously being a millennial in the Central Coast, having a lot of friends that are liberal and conservative, that on both sides, it just seems like, you know, you can throw data one way or the other, but people are so stuck on their own idea that they don't want to give it up almost because they've invested so much time. But B, I think this is just more on the political side. Kind of what I've seen is, you know, you have one political candidate that, yes, we have Sanders who's polling for climate change. But I think that people are wrapped up on so many other issues aside from climate change that, and this is coming from a conservative, what ultimately might be the thing to do, you know, if you want to talk to someone about climate change, is have that dinner party, bring it up, be intentional about it, because ultimately, if I, as a 24-year-old that's concerned about my wife and my daughter and how are they going to get by, and I'm not really too concerned on climate change right now, maybe, you know, just having those steps of, you know what, I'm going to be intentional, I'm going to have this dinner party, I'm going to talk about it. Yes, climate change exists, and here's why it is here's why it's an issue. Because ultimately, for me, you know, I have enough of, you know, everything else that I need that I'm looking for a politician in. You know, I have things that I like about just about every candidate. But I think if we have those conversations, if we, you know, in a non-aggressive, just open way, can say, hey, this is concerning to me. How do you feel about that? You know, not even, I want to convince you of this, but how do you feel about that? Because it's concerning to me. Then maybe that can open my eyes to go, wow, this is an issue that maybe I haven't been enlightened on at all, and I am concerned about that. So even just casually going at it and saying, you know what, let's educate our friends. Let's bring them to a dinner party. Let's explain to them why global warming is such a big deal, because they have other issues. They're not worried about that all the time. And so, you know, getting that input is so important to say, wow, maybe I do need to vote for Sanders. Maybe that's my guy and I just didn't see it before.
So
that makes sense.
It does, Tom. But I want to go back to what I said a little earlier in the program, because it sounds like you're married. And if you have this dinner party and you're trying to find consensus, to use that same tip that I talked about in marriages when you're trying to deal with conflict, is that instead of having the dinner party with the intention of changing the rest of your group's minds to be in line with you, to bring the dinner party together to help you understand why they all feel so passionately about the issues they do, that will help you have empathy for maybe another point of view. It may not change your position, but if you can approach this from, hey, I want to hear your side and why this matters to you, and then we can find common ground based on, I can hear why you're concerned about other issues and not climate change, given where you are in your life. But maybe here's how addressing climate change can help also meet your concerns. And so that would be my only suggestion about these dinner party ideas that I'm so big on, is to don't have them with the idea of educating others. Have them for the idea of learning their position and seeing how you can come from their position to help make change. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, I guess I maybe I misspoke or didn't say what I should have, but ultimately, yes, I think you're spot on. I just, knowing that you can go in, especially with an open mind, with people that also have open minds, and you can discuss, you know, freely, I think that's huge. So, yes, I agree.
Okay, that's, my last question for you, Tom, is what is the issue that matters most to you as a young man and a voter? What is your primary issue?
My primary issue is, well, mine is religious, so that's you know, 90% of my vote is swinging for, you know, a religious candidate. And so, again, that's a hard one to break from something other than religious convictions. But, yeah, that's mine.
All right. Thank you, Tom, for taking the time to call. And, yes, Jackie, the reminder that, you know, we have a lot of things that drive how we want to elect our officials, and religion isn't one of them. So that's, you wanted to add to that.
Well, I just wanted to backtrack just a little bit and add a quick note on this argument that the caller before this gentleman called, where some of these people get confused about the arguments because on one hand they're being told one thing. I'll use climate change again as an example. They're being told if we start to cut back on fossil fuels, you're going to lose jobs. And I just want to quickly say that's a false argument now because the solar and wind business is now providing more jobs than even the coal industry. And there is something to what presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders is saying, that if we start to rebuild our infrastructure, that too also creates jobs. And these kids need to have something to look forward to. This is a serious problem for them. They're coming out, they're graduating, they have their degrees, and there are no jobs out there for them. I mean, there are, but specialized in fields. So I think we have to – this is an old industrial argument that the idea that the economy is going to be ruined if we get off of fossil fuels.
So the idea then, if you're having these dinner parties, is to listen to everyone's sides. But if you want to, you know, educate yourself on – what might be alleviating the fears of the people who are anti-climate change legislation is to, yes, to be able to help them feel more comfortable. Because, again, the conversation started with anxiety in voting. Right. Are we voting with our rational, intelligent minds, or are we voting with our emotional responses? And, again, the way that arguments are set up to sell you, to persuade you to believe something that may not necessarily be true. And I take you back to the whole 1930s approach to persuasive speaking that's called the Monroe's motivated sequence. I can't say it. Monroe's motivated sequence is this very specific five-step way of persuading people to buy into an idea that may not be in their best interest. And it's how we set up all advertising today. Monroe's sequence is basically to grab someone's attention, explain to them that there is a need that they need to address, to show them ways that they can address that need, to help them visualize how much better life will be once they've addressed that need, and then to move them towards action. And we see it when it comes to selling, you know, body spray, right? You didn't know that you needed body spray, never thought about it, but you see this advertisement where this sad sack person is wandering through life and they say something like, do you ever feel lonely in the world or unloved? And you look at the commercial and you think, oh my gosh, I have felt lonely and unloved. And so you have caught my attention. And then they say, you know, you need to stop smelling like an average human being because that's preventing people from loving you. And you think, oh no, I didn't know that was a problem, but now I'm really concerned about my scent. And so the next part says, but we have a product for you that will help you not smell like the average human and will bring you more love in your life. So absolutely. Now you're hooked in a little bit, and they show you the Axe body spray or whatever it is. And the next image is of this, you having a great time in life surrounded by people who love and adore you because you now use Axe body spray. So as the person watching this ad, you're in. Yes, I want to buy this because I want love in my life and I can see myself having love in my life. And then the next thing is how you can buy this product.
And, well, and I just add to that real quickly that the selling point also works with fear.
Been my point, okay, we're talking about how we sell political movements. When it came to, if you watch political ads, you know, you'll see pictures of refugees running through, you know, over the fence, or immigrants coming over the fence, and then you'll have a voiceover saying, you know, we have immigration at an all-time high and jobs are being taken, and that catches your attention.
Right.
And then it talks about, we need to stop this immigration, we need to stop our jobs from being taken from us. Here is a plan that we have to stop that. You can elect our person. Here's your life now. If you elect our person, immigration is stopped. You have a job. You and your children can be playing in your front yard. And they show pictures of this and how beautiful life can be. And then the last picture is of the candidate they want you to elect. It is all Monroe's motivated sequence. It works on your fear. And the same sequence is how we ended up with the Japanese in internment camps during World War II, right?
Yes.
That there was an outcry that the Japanese citizens were plotting to kill Americans. And that caught our attention. We were afraid as a nation during World War II. And right. So the next statement was that we need to protect our nation from these potential Japanese citizens who are going to try to take over. And so to reduce the threat, we have a solution. The Americans are like, yes, we have to reduce the threat. So they introduced the internment camps and then the visualization of how we can all live peacefully and how nice. We'll have the Japanese internment camps and they'll be taken care of and we'll be safe. And then finally, you know, contact your senator or send us money or vote, you know, for this candidate.
Right.
That fear mongering, that fear sequence is what gets us rooted into our ideology of how we're going to vote. So yes, if we're going to change the conversations, we have to have the rational arguments that are going to help quell the fear, you know, to show the statistics or to show the alternative that's going to really happen, right? That if we talk about climate change, to show the statistics, but not to ram down someone's throat all the reasons they're wrong, but to say, I understand why you're fearful, because you fear losing your job or you fear the end of the world. And so it's easier to just go with politicians who speak to your fear. But here's really what could happen. And that's how we make change. 805-781-3875. Is it Will?
Yes.
Hi. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for this program. I got into it kind of in the middle, but I have quite a few things to kind of hit on, and you probably won't allow me to, and I probably don't deserve it. But,
well, give me a couple of the important points.
The first thing that I wanted to share was Tom before me said some very interesting things as a conservative and as a Christian, but at the same time as a young family person.
Mm-hmm.
And he said one of the things that I think is very heartening for Americans to look at within the evangelical Christian movement and so on for the country and facing some very difficult questions and facing them in very practical and in very real ways, that they can take an issue as important as global warming is and see that it's going to affect their family, see that it's a reality that it is really not a political problem. It is a commercial problem in the way that our political body has evolved. Basically, I think one of the things that turned people off so badly about politics is that it really has become nothing more than performance art. At its best, over the history of America and other countries too, it's much, much more than that. But as corporations have become more and more important and more powerful, have been granted power that they don't deserve or that basically is unconstitutional if anybody in the government was strong enough to face up to that, we would see that we are having laws proposed by laws written by think tanks from the various powerful corporations. We don't see people being punished for the sins that they have committed in the name of corporations and to the benefit of corporations, etc. And your idea about talking to people at a dinner party, sitting down and really discussing, I think is it needs a next step. I think it's very important, and I think the point that you make about how sincerely important it is not to try and prove that you're right over somebody else, but to share, to see the problem, have both sides kind of define the problem that you're discussing, and then see your commonalities, because the commonality is really there. People on both sides of political viewpoint are in a diminishing middle class. They are afraid of terrorists. They are sensing a sense of lack of any kind of power or control over their life in the world in which they live. They're overwhelmed. And when you sit down and you kind of fess up to those things, you realize, you know what, we're really, really much closer together than we think we are. We might not match up on guns. We might not match up on birth control. We might not match up on certain other things. But where, first of all, do we start? And one of the things that that dinner party needs to go next to is to grassroots, because I found just living in Morro Bay, since we have a new city government that has come in over the last few years, that the things that are now done in the name of the community are so much more in line with the majority of the community, and that you kind of build up your confidence a little bit. You start seeing people that you have some commonalities with. You start feeling like you have some allies, and you don't feel so much like you have enemies, just people of a different opinion. And those cities, we're beginning to realize, are becoming more important and more powerful in our country, as they have put up great blocks to oil pipelines and so on and so on, indigenous communities, etc.
Well, Will, I'm going to have to cut you off because it sounds like you could go on and on about something that I think a lot of us are feeling, is that maybe the grassroots is where we want to go. And Brian, you've been waiting. Thank you for waiting. You wanted to join in on this idea of how things affect us locally.
Oh, I was just going to say that basically it seems like going after a local economy is kind of beneficial in the idea of, like you said, with the dinner parties, mm-hmm. advertising. If I advertise about something, basically you don't know who I am, and you don't, you know, what is my word to you. But if you're doing a local economy or these dinner parties, you're going to respect your friend's opinion more than somebody else's who's just from wherever. And having a local economy is going to make you look at where you're, you know, where you're getting your stuff. And you're not going to be this big corporation that can, you know, basically mistreat people or the environment without the entire community around you figuring it out. And I think it is a way towards change, and how Will was talking about grassroots and what happened in Morro Bay, it is a way of the local economy will influence people to look a certain direction on how things are done. And kind of in my mind is like respecting people is the of utmost importance. So that local economy is going to, you know, kind of help solve a lot of these problems of environmental pollution or disputes, in the sense that you, when you're, you know, having a dispute with somebody you know of or in a community where you guys can communicate because you know each other, things get resolved a lot easier. So
I agree, Brian, and thank you for bringing it into local, kind of bringing it a full circle, because it's kind of brought us back to where I started this conversation, is that when I look at my friends who believe differently than I do politically, I feel like if I don't try to bridge that gap with my friends and try to find common ground and find things that we agree on and to talk about how our votes can come together and be more powerful, then we're never going to see any change. Because you said, if we don't even talk to our neighbors or our friends about this and we expect the larger picture government bodies to make change, it's not going to happen. And that we have to find our way back to some sort of political discourse, polite political discourse, get out of our silos, find the common ground, and then our votes won't just cancel each other out. We actually might be able to come together and vote in ways on small local issues, as Jackie was mentioning, on propositions that can make greater change. We may not be able to elect the person that's going to change the world, but if we can come together with our neighbors and find common ground, we can start movements that will ultimately change the world. Jackie, I want to thank you for coming in today.
Oh, sure, thank you. Boy, that moved fast.
The hour goes fast. You can read Jackie's words at truthout.org. She shares her wisdom there on a regular basis, and check out their website for a non-biased, nonpartisan information on all sorts of issues. Jackie's also going to be my guest in a few weeks talking about the power of poetry to heal.
Oh,
and I
great.
Look forward to that.
I look forward to it, too.
And I hope we'll continue this conversation either on my website, the reluctanttherapist.com, com, kcbx.org. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Our Facebook page is available. Continue this discussion with your neighbors, and I look forward to visiting with you again next Tuesday at 2. Thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX.